As we take our places, total strangers with familiar faces. I can never forget that look in your eyes, but you've already forgot me once we said our goodbyes. I won't let that be the end. It's something I can still defend. You know it's somewhere deep in your heart. Fire and love, that spark can start. No, I love you to death.
Love you to death.
I'll keep fighting till my last breath. You're the woman I love and I simply adore. I long to have you in my arms once more. You know I'll never forget,
never forget
how you left that night with no regret. The pain from that moment still haunts me today. The specter of love that's gone.
WRCT 88.3 FM. FM. My name's DJ Tony Tunes, and you just heard Love You to Death, It Promises You Made, and It Must Be Love by Ethosign. All songs that you can stream on all streaming platforms. But that closes up our Valentine's Day episode. Hope you all enjoyed, and I'll be seeing you all next weekend. Take care, and God bless.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
We tend to have an idea and want to do the business cards and set up a website right away and then say we're in business, right? And especially with social media, everybody is an influencer type of thing. We don't take enough time to truly understand the problem that we're solving and discovering the customer and to whom we're solving that problem for. All successful businesses solve a void in the marketplace, and we have to understand that. And that's a process of taking the time before you even start writing that business plan. You have to understand and do your customer discovery, problem discovery. Is the problem I think I'm helping with this particular business indeed the problem? And who are my customers?
Dr. Tiffany Bussey, founding director of the Morehouse Innovation and Entrepreneurship Center. As director of the Morehouse Innovation and Entrepreneurship Center, Bussey managed planned teams of faculty, staff, and consultants to achieve the goal of the center, which is to assist in the development of minority entrepreneurship through scholarly research, training, and consulting services. She's also an adjunct professor of entrepreneurship at Morehouse College. Under her leadership, this transformational program has been instrumental in generating millions of dollars in revenue for small African-American and underrepresented businesses in Atlanta. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Morehouse Innovation and Entrepreneurship Center with Dr. Tiffany Bussey, In Black America.
Like I mentioned, we started off with primarily work in the DoD Mentor Protege program, and then we had the awesome opportunity to write for a significant grant with J.P. Morgan Chase, who has been one of our early supporters of this work. And at the time, like any small business, we were asked to find something that the market currently wasn't offering. And so we started with helping startup businesses. I would call it industry agnostic. It wasn't focused, but just to help businesses start. At the time in Atlanta, there were very few other organizations focusing on helping Black founders start businesses. So that's where we started in terms of the community work that we were doing. We have evolved. We are now focused on construction as far as the industry pillar. Healthcare is another one for us, and information technology. I would also say that we're currently looking at sustainability and climate change as another focus area, again, given, you know, you're constantly doing that search, that strategic search, where are the gaps in the marketplace, and that's where it's leading us to right now.
Dr. Tiffany Bussey has over 20 years experience in various aspects of business management for corporate, small business, educational, and nonprofit organizations. Formed in 2004 as a unit of Morehouse College, the Innovation and Entrepreneurship Center has continually operated with an internal and external focus to promote innovation and entrepreneurship with people of color. The center's program has changed the lives of generational families in the community and introduced the possibility of generational wealth where there was none. The secret to their success lies in comprehensive formula they develop, guiding these businesses through every aspect of the process, including securing capital. To date, the center has reached 2,100 students, impacted over 400 small businesses, and created 850 new jobs. Recently, In Black America spoke with founding director Dr. Tiffany Bussey.
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. I was born in Belize, Central America, and just had the fortunate time of spending some time there in the last couple of weeks. So grew up in Belize all the way through high school and then came to the United States to attend college. I have gone to the College of St. Elizabeth in New Jersey and had a really awesome experience, started my first year careers in New York, and then kind of moved up the East Coast to Washington, D.C., where I met my husband, and now in Atlanta, Georgia, for the past 32 years.
You majored in economics in college?
I sure did, and I still believe it's one of the fundamentals that everyone should understand because it tells you so much about how the whole business model and this experience that we're doing with capitalism works. And so, yes, that was my first go-to in understanding this model.
Prior to you going to Morehouse, what were your other occupations?
Sure. So I think anyone doing economics and really being ambitious, I just knew that I would love Wall Street, and that was my goal. And so indeed, right after undergrad, I spent a few years with Merrill Lynch, getting my, as they would say, get your teeth into understanding the stock market, but it was not for me. And so I had the most fortunate opportunity of then going to Washington, D.C., and I got the bug at that time with federal contracting, worked for a small 80 company that really showed me how to grow and seeing people that look like me, starting businesses, being part of the 8A program, really doing well, and selling companies and starting companies. And From there, I was hooked with small business, truly understanding how to help them grow and scale. Like I shared, I was fortunate enough to then move to Atlanta, Georgia, and could not find work in the federal space. So I'm one of those accidental kind of career person in terms of entrepreneurship. Was not my goal to be in this role of what I call an entrepreneur activator or assisting folks to become entrepreneurs. So I had to become one myself. I started a consulting firm helping people to write grants and understand the federal market space. And my first job, kind of running with HBCUs, but with Morris Brown College at the time, helping them to organize a contract, not a grant, but a contract that was given to Morris Brown and understanding how that works. And so, as they said, the rest was history. We developed a program around that work at Morris Brown, really helping HBCUs understand how to run a business of doing contract work. I think academic institutions understand how to do grant work very well, but the contract side of things is a little bit different. And we developed a what was then called the Morris Brown Research Institute, and went on to have a body of work. Morris Brown ran into some of the accreditation problems that they had, and we had to find a new home. And so I shopped that. Fortunate for me, I'm in Atlanta that has the largest consortium of HBCUs, and literally across the street went to Spelman, who welcomed me in the program there and was there for quite some time, and then ended up across the street at Morehouse, where I've been for the past 20 years, really running what I would call a business construct of understanding how to help businesses run businesses within the construct of the academic institution.
Before we get into the center, I caught the economic bug while in high school, which was an elective. Why do you think economics should be mandatory for our young people today?
Sure. So a lot of what we understand, especially from, so economics is split into sort of like two sides of the coin. There's the macro side, which helps you understand the total big picture. How does the economy run? What are the elements that feeds into it to make banking run and to understand the movement of money and interest rates, which drives everything? And then the microeconomic side of things really get to the firm level. How do you run a firm and understand economies of scale and those types of things? And when you look at the basics of running any business, or I would say any transaction, whether it is for starting a business or even running your own household, it comes back to those elements that you get and really discover from a macro and at a micro level in economics. So I do think the basics of understanding how money works, because everything flows from money, is essential. I would definitely encourage anyone to understand, even if it's your own private household, how do I manage that? How do taxation work? Because you are going to pay taxes, and that's the system that everything is based on. So from that perspective, highly, highly encourage it. We're learning more that the earlier students and everyone understand that, the better it is to understand the flow of everything else that runs and making decisions on your career, quite frankly.
You started the Innovation and Entrepreneur Center in 2004. Why so?
So, like I shared, we had this body of work that was being shopped around, really started from Morris Brown and then ended up at Spelman for a few years. And in that discussion, the work at that time was really centered around HBCU's involvement in federal contracting. I was involved in recruiting faculty members and students to be engaged with federal contract work. And I had a discussion at the time then with the dean of the business school at Morehouse, Dean John Williams, and I shared with him what this work was about. And he said, tell me that again, that you could actually do this work through the institution and have the model, everything above cost comes back to the institution to run a center that students can then learn how to start businesses. And I guess with his vision, he welcomed it. At the time, Morehouse was considering starting a center focused on students understanding not only how to graduate with a degree, but how do you understand how to start a business, not only look for a job, but create jobs through businesses, right? And as I explained it to Dean Williams at the time, I said, we can actually bring this program over to Morehouse, start a center with no money from the institution, but from the monies that would be created through this program. And he said, makes good business sense to me. And that's how that all started and created at Morehouse. We did contract work through the Department of Defense Mentor Protégé Program, where Morehouse and other HBCUs support larger organizations such as your IBMs or your Lockheed in helping them getting small business to become part of their supply chain. We provide that mentoring and part of the, to these what they call protege teams at the time, and through using students and faculty. And that's how that all started and has grown. I am pleased to say that 20 years into this, we have done over $82 million in contract work through the center in helping small businesses grow, touched over 400 small businesses and really helped them to grow and scale and help them create over 850 new jobs. That is significant. That's a goal. That's what we're doing. I like to say the mission is to help start, scale, and grow Black businesses, quite frankly, because of who we are at Morehouse.
Are there any particular businesses that you all focus on?
So for us, this is our business, right? I usually also start off and say that I am entrepreneurial also because this is my entrepreneurial venture or the team's entrepreneurial venture. And so we learned a lot. Like I mentioned, we started off with primarily work in the DoD Mentor Protégé Program. And then we had the awesome opportunity to write for a significant grant with JP Morgan Chase, who has been one of our early supporters of this work. And at the time, like any small business, we were asked to find something that the market currently wasn't offering. And so we started with helping startup businesses. I would call it industry agnostic. It wasn't focused, but just to help businesses start. At the time in Atlanta, there were very few other organizations focusing on helping Black founders start businesses. So that's where we started in terms of the community work that we were doing. We have evolved. We are now focused on construction as far as the industry pillar. Healthcare is another one for us, and information technology. I would also say that we're currently looking at sustainability and climate change as another focus area, again, given, you know, you're constantly doing that search, that strategic search, where are the gaps in the marketplace, and that's where it's leading us to right now. I would also share that as we pivot away from startups, we are now fully focused on what we call mid-sized firms, helping firms to really grow and scale. They're generally over $2 million in annual revenues, have been in business about 3 to 5 years. Those are the businesses that we have decided to really focus our energy in helping them grow and scale. A lot of what is said in terms of entrepreneurship as the magic bullet in helping closing the racial wealth gap in this country using entrepreneurship doesn't focus on these mid-sized firms. And what we know from the data is that it's these mid-sized firms that exponentially change that ratio, right? Provide employment, add use capital. Those are the firms. And so that's one of the reasons why we're now focused on that. And of course, on the flip side, we also work with our students. We've stood up a minor in entrepreneurship at Morehouse and really work with our students to understand if they are not entrepreneurs when they leave and graduate, at least they have the fundamentals and what it means to be an entrepreneur later on in their careers.
I understand. This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. Tiffany Bussey, the founding director of the Morehouse College Innovation and Entrepreneurship Center. Dr. Bussey, what is your definition of a small business?
For me, a small business is one that has a particular product or service in mind already. And I will also offer the definition a little bit different as comparing it to a startup. So a startup is one that has an idea, has what we call in academic language a hypothesis. I think this is something I should offer. And they're searching for that business model, searching to find out, is this indeed the product that needs to be there? A small business, however, has already found that. They have that product. I am selling 10 widgets, or I'm selling caps, I'm selling shirts. They have that, and they have opened their business, and they're selling that product. Really driving revenue. They have a set business model. They have a revenue structure that they are going at, and they're no longer searching. They may iterate, but they are very much set. So you would see those small businesses open for business, whether it is, and again, the definition in terms of size varies so widely. And John, I will tell you that perhaps it is that wide definition of a small business that perhaps creates some of the issues that we have in even growing them. If you go to the SBA, the Small Business Administration definition of it, it could go anywhere in terms of revenue from 100,000 to well over 100 million in revenue, right? Depending on the classification of what it is that you're selling. So I like to say that it is not what you're selling or the number of revenues or the number of employees that defines a small business, but it is how they are doing it. What is the business model? Have they already found the business model that they are executing? That makes them a small business. If you're still searching, you're probably in a startup stage of a business. I hope that makes sense.
It does. Are individuals coming to you prior to starting a business and or they are already in business?
As I shared, when we first started, our programs were pretty much focused on startups. So those were those that think they had an idea. I'm exploring this. I want to start this. In the early stages, I would say perhaps the first 10 years of the center's existence. Now, in the past 10 years, we are now fully focused on what we call a cohort model. So it is only at the time of application that we invite folks to engage with us. Very specific to the industry. What we have found, again, because we're intentionally focused on scaling these businesses, is that if we work with what we call opportunity partners, which are usually your large corporations, such as your IBMs, your large general contracting companies, such as Holder or, if we work directly with them to understand what it takes to grow a small business and have them a part of their supply chain, they're partnered with us and we bring companies in specifically that can meet those opportunities. Because for us, our program is focused on access to capital, which is a lot of the big discussion, but the other part of that is access to contracts. You need revenue. If you don't have revenue to grow your company, I don't care how much capital you have, your company will probably fail. And so one of the uniqueness about our program is making sure that we have what we call the three C's, capital, contracts, and connections. And it's that intentionality of working with small to mid-sized companies, what we call mid-sized firms, again, a couple million dollars in revenue, have been in business for a while, they've already gone out of the startup stage, then we intentionally work with them to scale them because those are the kind of companies that will employ others and really move to close this income inequality gap that we have in this country. Now, I will say for our student programs, which is I'm also in an adjunct faculty at Morehouse and engage in designing those programs, our student comes to us with new ideas. They have a hunch. They may have a product. I'll tell you an example. For example, one that's running a food truck, the only student-run food truck in the country, I believe, but in called Auntie's Spot. We engage with them. We help them write their business plan. We help them find new ways of marketing. They just went through a program that we've had for concessions at the airport. So we love that, and we help our students wherever they're at. Another example of a student sort of early stage example is cartoonists. So we also work with artists. Kamarli just graduated, and he wrote his couple of books, cartoon books and film. And by the way, just won a film award from the Liberian Film Festival. So we're very proud of the work we're doing with both our students and with businesses in the community.
Are there any boxes that need to be checked prior to an individual starting a business?
Yes. I think that when you start a business, there's both sides to it. There's the technical knowledge. And then there is the what I would call the mindset. We know that there are certain characteristics, if you will, that makes an entrepreneur, that ability to be resilient, that ability to be comfortable with failure, that ability to understand no and still get up every day. One of the things we don't talk about as much as particularly as it relates to those in our community is understanding that failure is okay. You know, we still have a very high percentage. 92% of our businesses will still fail within the first 3 years. We know that. But it's that ability to still continue, the ability to assess risk and be able to do it in a very calculated way. And then there's the technical side. We tend to have an idea and want to do the business cards and set up a website right away and then say we're in business, right? And especially with social media, everybody is an influencer type of thing. We don't take enough time to truly understand the problem that we're solving and discovering the customer and to whom we're solving that problem for. All successful businesses solve a void in the marketplace, and we have to understand that. And that's a process of taking the time before you even start writing that business plan. You have to understand and do your customer discovery, problem discovery. Is the problem I think I'm helping with this particular business indeed the problem? And who are my customers? Who is it that I'm going to sell to? You can't have a successful company without customers. And sometimes we forget that. We fall in love with the idea of the business first, and then we kind of try to back into it. And so I would say we really, really have to rethink the way we think about starting businesses. And once we start them, what's the type of research and technical knowledge? Take the time up front to do that work before you start investing other time of, you know, that flashy business card and going around networking and those types of stuff. That will come, but I think that we really do need to spend more time truly understanding what it is and why we are doing it. What's the why? And when you start doing that and truly fall in love with your customers and not the idea, I think we'll see more successful businesses.
What makes Atlanta such a hotbed of entrepreneurship and this program?
Oh, my goodness. Love it, love it, love it. And thank you for that, for the recognition. We are the number one urban area in terms of Black businesses. But the other side, John, that we don't talk about much is that 96% of our businesses in Atlanta are what we call solopreneurs. One employee, and that's the founder or the owner. We have to change that. So short answer in terms of what makes Atlanta, I think it's the ecosystem. I think it's the community. I think it's the history that's here. When we look at what makes businesses thrive, it's the whole ecosystem. It is the community. It is the culture, the other C that we need. And it is that spirit of having policies in place. I must say that, yes, we can have all the knowledge and things that in terms of what we do at Morehouse, but changing of policies and systemic barriers is equally as important as we do this work. And I think with the history of Atlanta being open to encouragement of diversity of thought, of diversity of engagement, and to seeing everyone thrive is an important piece. We also have some wonderful institutions. Of course, I mentioned the largest collaboration of HBCUs, and that is very, very important, a black middle class that encourages and see each other successful. I think entrepreneurship is not, it's what we call, it's a game sport, right? You need it, and you need individuals. No one, I know we idolize entrepreneurs and individuals, but no one really builds a company or a business by themselves. And so you need that network of support, of collaboration, of both schools, government entities, private entities, and everyone working together. And I think that's some of the magic that we're seeing happening in Atlanta.
This past June, you all hosted 100 stakeholders at the 2024 Ascend National Conference. Why the conference and what was accomplished?
Thank you. So the Ascend program is one of the programs that I'm so most proud to be a part of. It is a national program that focuses on bringing together a network. I spoke about the importance of that ecosystem. Well, that's exactly what Ascend is doing. It's building an ecosystem across the country of business schools doing this work, of working with businesses in the community to help scale businesses to close the racial inequality gap. And so Morehouse is fortunate to be a part of that network. The work is led by the University of Washington Foster School of Business. We are also joined this year with Northwestern Kellogg School of Management. And to be a part of that elite group of business schools focused on doing this work is of tremendous pride. We each have a cohort that we run, and Morehouse was privileged to kind of host the conference this year. We're running another Ascend National cohort. Actually, we're currently in recruitment with a residential program at the end of September on the campus of Morehouse. The way the program works is that each business school that is involved kicks off the cohort with in-person residential session at each one of our campuses. So this year we'll have 60 companies going through the program at the same time. And we have what we call an opportunity partner. For us, it's IBM that's working lockstep with us to find these procurement opportunities that these 20 businesses that will be going through our cohort that we'll be aligned to. Again, the access to capital. We have capital providers such as JP Morgan Chase that has been very fortunate in sponsoring this program and allows for businesses to be a part of the 7-month program at scholarship, free of charge to them to participate. And so we align them with procurement opportunities with IBM and others so that they can grow and scale. And very, very important to us are the KPIs that really come out of that program. I'll just give you an example. For the past Ascend cohort that we had, in 7 months, we touched 20 companies that really had about $20 million in new contracts just from that 7 months and going through that program. It is very important for us that 150 of those new jobs that were created by the 20 companies in that program, this is the type of KPIs that we're looking for and the success that we're looking for, and that comes out of the Ascend program.
As a participant in this ecosystem, have you seen banks be more receptive to lending money to African-American-owned businesses?
Good question, right? There are some that are better than others. And trying to move the needle on that particular issue has been pushing a boulder up the hill, right? I mentioned that this work, a lot of this work has been sponsored by JP Morgan Chase, and I have to really applaud them for the work that Chase is doing in leading in that effort, in really trying to change the model in which capital is deployed. I'll also share on a small business case some of the things that we're doing in that area. We are fortunate to be part of a group that has done what we're calling the Atlanta Flex Fund.
Dr. Tiffany Bussey, founding director of the Morehouse Innovation and Entrepreneurship Center. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
In Black America and KUT Public Radio are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows on the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr.
I'm not a racist freak, the teacher.
You still didn't have the hedges.
Number one, they want to run about the gun. I wasn't licensed to have one. The minute they see me, fear me, I'm the epitome of public enemy. Use a few without clues, I refuse to blow fuse. They even had it on the news.
I am not a New Yorker, but I have worked in New York City most of my life. I started at the New York Daily News at the age of 21. I drove into the New York City area. I took the train the first year before I got my NYP plates. And ever since I got them plates, I never looked back because it allowed me to drive and park different. And New York is a troublesome place to drive into and try to find parking. But yeah, as a journalist in New York, I have been on every subway, been to every borough. I used to cover high school sports, spent a lot of time in Staten Island and the Bronx, Kennedy versus Clinton. And then when I was on the news desk at night, you know, on the subway, covered education for the editorial board. So I'm at the teachers union and, you know, all throughout the city. So I've been through several mayors. You know, I remember when Dinkins was mayor and the Crown Heights situation happened. And I actually interviewed the one of Gavin Cato's dad when he was killed during that Crown Heights riot under Dinkins' administration. So I've been I'm a New York adjacent person, even though I'm from Jersey, in terms of New York having an impact on my life and career. So I've seen, I saw what happened with David Dinkins and how that Crown Heights riot upended his career and led us to Giuliani, because law and order was important during Dinkins' administration. Harlem had a lot of street vendors. Some of you remember back in the day, and I'm talking to you with institutional memory. I covered the street vendors, the African street vendors to be exact, who would line up along 125th Street with the incense and oils and the books and all of the cloths and all the different, every kind of thing you can get from Senegal or Ghana would be lined up along 125th Street. It was untenable for the people who had businesses there because the folk there, you know, didn't have a place to go to the bathroom. It was too, you know, sort of like the crime bill, how people like complain about the crime bill, but during the height of the crime, they were saying, do something. Well, Giuliani came in with this broken windows thing that cleared off everyone, and it changed the culture of Harlem. Some would say for the better. It led to gentrification. I would say not necessarily for the better. I think there should be a solution that involves the community as well. I also participated in the Apollo Theater renovation. Matter of fact, it was a tour that the New York Daily News' editorial board, of which I was a part of, went to the Apollo Theater when Percy Sutton and Charles Rangel were somehow overseeing something that was a historic landmark and then making money off of it. And we did these exposés, 11 editorials to be exact, which led to a Pulitzer. I'm going to say less about that. But I was in the rooms with Y.T. Walker and Al Sharpton talking about what needs to happen with the Apollo Theater. So inside out game, institutional knowledge right here, been in rooms. I watched Giuliani turn the city into a quasi-police state. I watched stop and frisk, not just suborn the rights of many, many millions of black men in particular, but also create a sort of fear under his watch. I think we had Abner Lee Weimer. I think we had Sean Bell. There were so many incidents of Patrick Dorisman. Gideon Bush, you know, there were so many people under siege in a city because the broken windows theory got rid of all of the squeegee guys, which I personally am okay with because I don't want dirty water on my windshield. I just got my car washed. No, thank you. No, thank you. I know you need to make a buck because you're unhoused. But how about we deal with the unhoused situation, which we still haven't, by the way. So I remember Giuliani. I remember 9/11. I was writing a column for the New York Daily News when 9/11 happened. And I remember Giuliani going into a bunker while Rudy Washington took over and got people out of the city safely and presided over what was one of the best, but also the worst, because Giuliani did not fund the first responders with walkie-talkies. I'm taking you through a little history just to say that institutional knowledge is important. It's important for people who are covering these cases, like Eric Adams. We're going about to talk about him in a second, to know some things. Journalism needs to be better. We need to have a depth of knowledge because people are going to the polls electing people like Eric Adams, former police officer, former Brooklyn Borough president. I remember when he got elected, I was like, that's strange that a police officer, like, I thought it was strange how he was borough president. Shout out to Brooklyn. Why did y'all do that? 866-801-8255. Because he's one of y'all. But sometimes we send people who look like us and they feel like us because they're from us, but they're not like us, meaning they're not going to do the things that need to be done when they get there. So here we have a mayor, and I'm not finished because 9/11, Giuliani in a bunker. He was on his way out of Gracie Mansion because he brought his mistress in. I remember the headlines. I was sitting in the newsroom when his wife, who we know, Donna Hanover, those of you who are from New York, yeah, she was a reporter on the news, on locally, on the news, his wife and his children in Gracie Mansion. He bringing a mistress in. And the city was like, oh, you suck. We don't like you. Maybe you'll get impeached. I don't know, but we're definitely not voting for you again. And then here comes 9/11. Then that brought in Bloomberg, right? Bloomberg's going to put the city back together. And then he got broke the rules and got a third term. Businessman, billionaire. Should he be mayor? Is he a Republican? Is he a Democrat? A lot of conversation around that. Then we had de Blasio, who I felt like was the most low rent mayor you ever had. And he got elected primarily because his son had a nice afro. But maybe there was another reason. I don't know. Again, spent most of my career in New York, and I've watched him, you know, and maybe it wasn't wrong for him to look at the outer boroughs over New York City, but that's where your money's being made. You're running. You're the manager. You're the CEO of the city. You want to make sure the city where the money is made is clean and safe and all of those things. Yes, the outer boroughs deserve attention. It's nice that you shovel your yard. It's nice. But I don't know if he was a great mayor. I don't know. But then we had this ranked voting thing. And this is now I'm on the radio, right? We're going through this ranked voting. And there were a lot of good, solid candidates who could have, including Ray McGuire, who actually can run a whole company, could probably run a city really well. Definitely a stand-up guy, Ray McGuire. Definitely Maya Wiley. Definitely cares, going to show up and going to put together a good team because she's solid. And because of that, the votes got split 3-4 ways because there were a lot of solid candidates. And here this guy comes, and I said, oh, this is not going to end well. How is Eric Adams? He's a whole ass mess, y'all. And I'm not even getting to the personal stuff, which I can, but I won't, because this is irrelevant. Or maybe it's not. Maybe how a person runs their life is how we should determine whether or not they should run the country, Donald Trump and others. Maybe that should be a marker. You know, if your life is a mess, I don't know. So we gonna just hand you the keys to the city and to the state and to the damn. Give you the nuclear codes? You can't even keep a wife. I'm not talking about Eric Adams right now. I'm talking about Trump. But I don't think there's any difference, per se, maybe. But it looks like where they have Sean Combs held in this Brooklyn jail might get crowded. Might get crowded because the mayor of New York City, innocent until proven guilty, 58-page indictment just came down last night. We were sitting at dinner. People were popping up on their phones. I had my phone turned off because I want to be present when I'm with people. Y'all know, those of you who've hung out with me at Healthy Wealthy Wise, you don't see me on my phone. I'm there. I'm there to be with the people. So I didn't know what was going on. Everybody's like, ooh, 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 ooh. And I was like, okay, good. Good, because we already seen his police chief step down. I think his education person stepped down. Like, folk resigning, people's houses being, searched. Boxes coming out of people's houses in his cabinet. So 58-page indictment. I printed it all out. Those of you who want to read it, which you should read all these indictments. You should know what is at stake here. But I'm going to give you a brief version. We'll tweet out, and I'm sure Zan in Nubia, shout out to the Nubians. I love it there. Zan in Nubia probably put the PDF in because she's just amazing, as are everyone, all the people in Nubia. But I'll just give you a breakdown of what's in the 58-page indictment, and I would love to hear from New Yorkers. And if you voted for Eric Adams, again, much like this election now, please tell me why. What was the main issue? What was the main issue? Because one could argue his early career as the head of 100 blacks in law enforcement. Who cares? This is how far back I go. He and Mark Claxton used to be regulars on my first radio show. And I used to do a morning show in New York City, 1600 AM WWRL, 6 AM to 10 AM Eastern. They would be on regularly talking about police brutality and other things. Mostly Mark Claxton. Shout out to him. Amazing human being. Well, I thought maybe there would be a possibility. But as soon as he got elected to Brooklyn Borough President, he changed the possibilities of more power. Then people were whispering that he could actually be a presidential nominee. I said, where? How? Who? But then we had Trump. So anything's possible. Anything's possible. But we got to want more, don't we? We should expect and want more from people who lead us. They should be better than the worst of us. I want my leaders to be great. And it's aspirational, right? It is something that we have to beat people into, not physically, but we have to cajole and push people into greatness when they are representing us, because they're representing us. Does that represent you, New York? All right, number one. First, there's a Turkish house bribery. It was a bribery back in September of 2021. Free business class flights to Ghana. This is the bribe for Adams and his partner. Worth $14,000. Oh, business class is $14,000 to Ghana. I didn't pay that. Let me just say that. I went to Ghana. Y'all know I went to Ghana. I ain't pay no $14,000 for no damn. And I flew first class. But I'm going to say less about that. Okay, action. Pressured FDNY to allow occupancy of Turkish house. So he went there. He said he was going to study. So it was a business trip. So New York paid for this trip to Ghana that he allegedly was there to check out some stuff. Okay. Construction company, straw donations. All right. This is back in December. And shout out to Chris Evans on Twitter, who also helped break this down. Construction company, straw donations, December 2020. Eric Adams allegedly accepted $10,000 in a straw donation from business people, number Fours Construction Company. Adams later assisted this same business with Department of Buildings issues. Hmm. Okay, and let me go back to the Turkish thing. So he pressured FDNA, fire department, to allow occupancy of Turkish houses at 821 United Nations. So he got the trip paid for to Ghana by the Turkish house people, and then he pressured FDNY to allow them to put their stuff in the United Nations 821. All right. $10,000 from this construction company, assisted the same construction company with Department of Buildings issues. Turkish university contributions. So according to this, the indictment, he accepted $10,000 in foreign contributions funneled through U.S.-based employees. Three employees made $2,000 contributions each, and then they were reimbursed. So that's like a little money laundering thing. And then back to another business, straw donation. He accepted $22,000 in straw donations from this business construction company. And then the company provided $1,250 to 10 employees who then donated the money back to Adams. Interesting. All right. Foreign contributions fundraiser. He accepted foreign contributions for 2025 campaign through straw donors. Foreign nationals paid $5,000 each to attend an event, and then the money was funneled through the United States citizens. So it's not, so it didn't look, so you know what you're doing. Because you know it's illegal to take money from a foreign agent, so you had it funneled through, allegedly, according to the indictment. Also, there were multiple incidents, instances of accepting free business class flights, luxury hotel stays. For example, 2019 trip to Turkey with free stay in a Cosmopolitan suite at the St. Regis Istanbul. That's fancy. That's fancy. Doesn't he get paid enough? I'm not going to get in the man's pockets, but, you know, and then one could say, oh, everyone does it. But this is what we are, we're saying Clarence Thomas and them shouldn't do it. I don't think we want Supreme Court justices taking trips and stuff. And I think it's unethical at the very least, even if it's not illegal, but they're saying it's illegal. All right, let me get more straw donations. According to the indictment, Eric Adams agreed to accept straw donations from business people. This is the sixth one now. Plan to use the company's drivers as straw donors. So they would give the money and the company would pay. So straw donations, I guess, a company that's not supposed to donate gives the money to other people who can donate. And then those donations go to the person that you want to influence to get things done. Now, Mayor Adams, I believe he makes $258,000 a year as mayor, and he has housing that he doesn't have to pay for, Gracie Mansion. He is among the highest paid mayors in the entire country, but New York is the largest city. So one could argue that he deserves that, right? But I don't know how this is going to all shake out, but I'm just going to say this with my full chest. I am not surprised. I'm not shocked or awed. I'm not clutching my pearls. Not at all. Okay. But it looks like, you know, if he's convicted, that federal prison where Puffy is, that also now houses Sam Bankman-Fried. As a matter of fact, fun little tidbit, Combs has been placed in the same cell in the Brooklyn jail with convicted crypto fraudster Sam Bankman-Fried, according to the New York Times. The two are not cellmates in the classic sense. They're not sharing the same jail room, but they're both sleeping in a larger dormitory style at the Metropolitan Detention Center with several other defendants who I'm sure are in the same class of fame and notoriety as they are. The Times confirmed that the arrangement, they confirmed this arrangement through a source, but the Bureau for Prisons declined to speak on the matter. So we don't know for sure, but the New York Times has got confirmation. And they got room for Eric Adams there. That could be very interesting. The Southern District of New York unsealed its 5-count indictment against Mayor Eric Adams in connection with the contributions to his 2021 mayoral campaign, including from wealthy foreign business people that we just mentioned, and at least one Turkish government official, which we just mentioned. The charges include 1 count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud, federal program bribery, and conspiracy to receive campaign. Well, he did actually, so there's no conspiracy. Receive campaign contributions by foreign nationals, illegal. 1 count of wire fraud, 2 counts of solicitation of a contribution by a foreign national, and 1 count of bribery. Adams has strongly denied any wrongdoings. He said, I'm innocent, and I will fight this with every ounce of my strength and spirit. So unlike others, like Al Franken, who didn't do this at all, you know, people with character sometimes, I got caught. Or, you know, this is too much for the city. The city deserves something better. It's too much drama. Let me step down. He's not stepping down. Matter of fact, I think he's going to do the Bob Menendez thing. until it gets too much. But I'm going to take you back. He was on a Breakfast Club. Just to give you some, those of you who don't know Eric Adams, and to me, this is not about Eric Adams, this conversation. This is about our capacity to elect people, because you don't know. It's just like dating, I guess. You don't know if a person's going to be a serial killer until, you know, until they reveal themselves. I'm not saying that he is. You don't know if a person's going to be, let me not be so hyperbolic, a horrible person, because people are always going to show their best, especially politicians. They're going to show you how great they are until they get in. But once you know, there should be no defense, people. Some of us knew, though, or at least suspected, that this was going to be a good thing for New York because there were better candidates. But we can do better, and we deserve better, and we should show up for ourselves and the future of the cities that we live in and the country that we live in, and we should not let bad people lead us because they represent us. They literally are our representatives. And if this is not you, this is not how you roll, character should be number one. We can get to policies later because a lot of people, if you've never been president, you're going to learn that job. Most people who are president have never been president before they were president. Things you're going to learn. I do know that vice presidents, though, get to see the job up close, like a Biden, for example, and now Kamala Harris, for example. But, once you realize who a person is, we should say something. But again, I don't pay taxes in New York. I just work there a lot. That's a lie. I do pay taxes in New York. I pay New York taxes. I can say whatever I need to say. Shoot, Smiths, you do too? Okay, we live in Jersey and pay New York.
Shit.
Come on now. So we got something to say. I pay taxes. All right.
My days are cooler. Nights are warmer. And I put the blame on you. Time moves slow. But my heart beats faster. Eyes are looking right at you. You give me something to believe in, just what I needed. You're the closest.
Joining me now, Alexi McCammon, host of the podcast In Sync and an MSNBC political analyst, along with Axios political reporter Steph Kite. Welcome, good to see you both. So, Alexi, we're seeing Harris narrowly leading in the battleground states. While the race is very tight, does the fact that she is ahead in all of them, with Pennsylvania and Nevada both outside the margin of error, does it indicate good things to her campaign about the trajectory at least?
Yeah, Alex, thanks for having me on, and I'm so happy to be on with you and Steph. Obviously, the polls are getting tighter and showing a closer race, but I think they're showing us a lot more, like that Democrats are on offense, not on defense necessarily. It's not just Harris who is performing well against Trump. If you look at the important Senate races in these battleground states, you'll see Democratic candidates overperforming their Republican challengers. And so I think what we're seeing is not just across the board, the race is tightening, but Harris is closing the gap. Down ballot Democrats are closing the gap. And also, of course, Donald Trump is trying to keep his lead on the economy, but Harris has closed that gap too.
Yeah. So, Steph, ahead of Harris's remarks at the border yesterday, you had the scoop that she would announce stricter asylum policies. It's an effort to fight back against claims that she and Biden have been too lenient on the border. But does she risk alienating voters on the left?
I mean, that is certainly a risk, but we've seen both Harris and President Biden move in the direction of embracing this tougher image on the border. We've seen it over and over again, not only in the policies they're rolling out, but also the language that they use on the campaign trail, the way they talk about immigration. We've seen Harris in particular really embrace, her past as a prosecutor, saying she's going to prosecute people who illegally come across the border. That's part of her promises to really crack down on illegal immigration coming across the U.S.-Mexico border. And it's pretty remarkable to see how far she's come, especially when you go back and you watch the clips from 2019, when she was in favor of decriminalizing illegal border crossings, when she was much more sympathetic to, focusing on getting people pathways to citizenship. It's very clear they see this as a vulnerability and something that they need to respond to. And, you saw that especially yesterday in hearing the way she was talking about the border issue and even the decision to go and visit it herself.
Yeah. Jake was just referencing the Gen Z vote, Alexi. Young voters could also play a pretty big role here. We've got nearly 42 million Gen Zers who are going to be eligible to vote. That includes nearly 8 million in the 7 critical battleground states. And there's a new poll of 18 to 29-year-olds. It's up by the Harvard Kennedy School, which found Harris with a 31-point edge over Trump. Now, that's not entirely surprising, but what is notable, 74% of young Democrats say they will definitely vote. Compare that with 60% of young Republicans. So what do you make of the enthusiasm gap?
It's so fascinating. What a change from when Joe Biden was still running for re-election. I mean, I don't think Democrats would have the influencers, you know, flacking for Biden in the way that they are for Harris. I don't think we would see this big of an enthusiasm gap without Harris. She's really given new life to the Democratic Party and to their base voters, frankly, who they need to turn out and to show up, even and especially if it is their first time voting. And you know what's really interesting, Alex, is that Democratic operatives and some pollsters even say that they think the youth vote has been underpolled so far. They think that there is some sort of constituency of young voters who are new Harris voters that aren't yet being captured in polling, basically suggesting she could be doing even better against Trump nationally than we're seeing now.
What's interesting, Steph, Democrats are pushing for greater voting access on college campuses. What effect could that have, especially in swing states?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the polls, when you're looking at every single poll in these battleground states being within the margin of error, you realize that turning out any particular favorable group of voters could make or break the entire election. So it makes sense for Democrats to be focused on college campuses, targeting groups of voters who have historically not had very high voting turnout rates compared to other age groups. And so those are the kinds of voters that could make or break the election come November. And one thing that's interesting in just my conversations with sources watching the polls is that it's so close. You're hearing from both sides who are able to take that data and spin it into what they view as a positive way forward. Even I've been hearing from Republicans who point out that even though Harris has had, you know, a little bit of an edge over Trump in some of these battleground states, that they compare Trump's polling this year to polling in 2016 and they see improvement there. So Republicans still see a path forward, even as Trump is down, you know, a couple points in most of these polls.
So here's something coming at you, Alexei, because Trump is trying to raise money any way he can. He's now selling a commemorative coin costing $100. His wife, Melania, now selling a pendant costing $600. And then there are the watches. Most cost $500, but there's a gold model that costs a whopping $100,000. Where is this money even going? Does it go to the campaign or does it go to Trump personally?
I think we all know where any money that gets into Trump's orbit ultimately ends up, which is benefiting himself in some way. Obviously, he still has legal fees to pay off and will face more legal challenges starting in the new year, no matter what happens in this election. But it's just another classic Trump grift. I mean, nothing screams I'm broke more than selling and hawking sneakers, Bibles, gold watches, coins, getting back into Bitcoin and NFT. I mean, I feel like he's trying to set himself up maybe for a post-election loss and open up some business avenues that way.
Last hour was suggested maybe HSN, Home Shopping Network. Anyway, Steph, let's look at the rules for the vice presidential debate on Tuesday between Governor Tim Walz and Senator J.D. Vance. They are similar to the presidential debates that we saw, but instead of microphones completely muted when it's not the candidate's turn to speak, the rules state, quote, CBS News reserves the right to turn off candidates' microphones. So as you look at Walz and Vance's communication styles, what do you expect to happen if mics stay turned on as the other candidate speaks?
It will be fascinating to see how this plays out, especially comparing kind of the two very different, experiences we've seen between the two VP picks. You know, Vance had a pretty difficult beginning after Trump named him his VP choice. We've heard reporting that Republicans were not sure he was the right choice. Meanwhile, Walz has been received with a lot of fanfare, a lot of support. I know one thing that we're definitely going to be hearing about from the two of them is talking about, you know, kind of their military experience. We can expect barbs there. What I'm curious about is whether Walz's kind of likable, chill personality still works in a debate format, or whether we see Senator Vance, you know, come forward a little bit more aggressively and if that works to his favor.
Okay. Last to you, Alexei, what are you expecting on Tuesday night at the debate?
I mean, obviously, Governor Walz doesn't have to play cleanup as much as Vance will have to. So that's certainly going to help him. And, you know, something fascinating the polls has found is that Walz has been overperforming with men, with male voters compared to J.D. Vance. Obviously, we know how he's tried to paint this picture of himself as some masculine candidate alongside Trump. So to Steph's point, we'll be very curious to see whether and how he almost tries to bully Walz on the stage or sort of take up more space than him in that way to be intimidating or masculine in his view.
Okay, I guess we'll see. Alexi and Steph, it's good to see you both. Come see me again. I like this combination.
Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, among many other things, 2024 was a series of reminders that corporate news media, tasked primarily with enriching the rich and shoring up entrenched institutions, will not, today or ever, do the liberatory, illuminating work of independent reporting that boldly speaks truth to power, that stands up for the societally voiceless, that provides space for the debates and discussions we need to move society forward, for those of us that believe that U.S. society needs to change. New.
Hi, this is Greg Keeler with Blue Rodeo here. 88.3 FM, WRCT, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Wir werden schon fette Beute, riefen Krieg und wollten Macht.